Welcome to In Search of the New Compassionate Male. My name is Clay Boykin. I support this podcast through my coaching practice. I help people visualize and harmonize, find direction and meaning, or simply get unstuck. Contact me at clayboykin.com for a free consultation. Now here's the latest episode of In Search of the New Compassionate Male. Don, how are you doing?
Well, it's been interesting. I had a first meeting of my implementing servant leadership class, and that was last Friday. And it's this time I just in the first meeting, I've learned to do this. So we just want to hear how you got here to servant leadership. Tell us about your journey. And at first it was kind of like a resume. Mm-hmm. And then I read some poems. And after that, the floodgates were open. And this struck me. It never struck me before. When someone, especially a lot of people, when that field takes over with a group of people, you know, you're all participating in the same field of intention and sharing. I'm not going to say it's mystical. I think it's real. I think it's there's a real measurable field, probably. We just don't measure it yet. But when that's happening, then everybody is growing together. And it's a feeling that can't be manufactured. Facts are necessary. Conceptual ideas are necessary. But they are not the only things that make up the full, rich expression of what it means to be human, but also what it means to be a compassionate male. Yeah. Also, there's a man named Dr. Tarr, T-A-R. His mother, I met him recently, his mother was in Auschwitz. And she was one of the twins, part of one of the twins that Dr. Mengele experimented on.
Oh my.
So she became an advocate later. She moved to Terre Haute, Indiana, married, and became an advocate for forgiveness. Mm. So I gave him the biography of Greenleaf because it has an awful lot to do with Terre Haute. And I really appreciated it. I'm going to see him tomorrow night. The State Museum now has an exhibit about her and her message. And they've done a documentary on her for public television. So I'm going to see that tomorrow night, too. But she stood in the gates of Auschwitz and read a letter about forgiveness. And until that moment, she could not get over the terrible effects of what had happened. And she was short with people and she realized that she was screwing herself by not forgiving.
That really, it's really sobering because last Friday I interviewed Dr. Rianne Eisler, and her story is that when she was 6 years old, in Austria, her parents, it was the Kristallnacht, and, you know, these people were being raided and they were being taken away, and her father was taken away. And luckily, the mother was able to do something but get the Gestapo to release the father. And they evacuated and got to Cuba and survived there until they came over to the U.S. You know, it's something how the right people show up at the right time, especially in these podcasts. I was talking about Dr. Rianne Eisler earlier. And her book, Nurturing Our Humanity, is a pretty incredible read. I skimmed it. I've gone back to take it to heart. You know, read the preface in the first chapter, and I erased to the back to get to the conclusion. And then I'm going to read the rest of the book. And what it's, I think, showing me is that, you know, well, I don't know what it's showing me. I don't know if I can put it into words yet, but I know that leadership for me, servant leadership, you know, is in the present with the people that I'm with the network that I connect with. And this whole other side of leadership, the leadership that she's demonstrated, taking from childhood, the atrocities that she witnessed and persevering through, and a brilliant woman taking all these different aspects and in this macro view of things to present another way to for us to live. And that's another form of leadership.
Yes, it is.
You know, to share, to take the difficulties and the challenges, horrific challenges, and then turn that in to something for the greater good. And she told us early on in the in our conversation, actually before we started taping, she said that she had lost her husband 6 weeks ago.
Oh.
Yeah. That, you know, both of them well up into years. And, yeah, the obituary said that he died of COVID. They'd been married for 45 years. And she shared that in their first 100 days of marriage, he wrote a poem a day to her.
Wow.
And she's publishing that now.
But you know, that's a generation that's fading away. Unfortunately, I think the lessons are also fading away.
Look at us now.
Yeah.
I've been so struck by Zelensky in Ukraine. And here's a guy who grew up Jewish in southern Ukraine. His father moved to Mongolia for 4 years, and they came back and lived in Kiev. This surprised me. He was, of course, a good student. He was always interested in theater, though. And he got a law degree. In 6 years, he got a law degree and a bachelor's degree and was licensed to practice law, but went back to theater and was highly successful there. He made his name in a feature film, which you can see in Russian on Netflix right now, called Servant of the People.
Really?
Yeah. And it was a take, kind of a spoof, of the current leadership of Ukraine, because he was anything but a servant of the people. He was crooked. He stole things. Nobody believed him. The film features Zelensky as a young man who's still living at home. And he, just for the heck of it, jumped into, I think his friends in the film put him in this presidential race. And one day in the morning, there is a knock on the door, and he'd won the race. And they'd come to take him to his office. He was shocked. So anyway, the whole thing was so successful, it went into a series for several years. When he then became genuinely interested in politics, he named his party Servant of the People. So it took this spoof and turn it into the world's most serious name, I think.
Wow.
And by the way, he also had his own production company, and he was the lead producer. He produced everything on Ukrainian television. He was ultimately responsible for it. So he had also dealt with a lot of people with big budgets for over there. And he had prepared himself without knowing what he was preparing for.
Mm-hmm.
To be president, a wartime president at that. And that really strikes me because, you know, Clay, that, I mean, you're kind of like me, you know, you were at Motorola for a long time, mm-hmm. but you did a lot of other things too.
Oh, yeah.
And you have since created new things. You weren't preparing for this when you were 17 years old by name. You didn't have a straight line drawn from then to here. And yet you prepared for it all along the way. Because I suspect, I'd like to hear you talk about this. I suspect you followed what lured you. That's L-U-R-I-D, but L-U-R-E-D, and kind of went with that. And it tended to resolve itself out in unexpected ways.
Gosh, you're so right. And I have to say that, and this is not unique to me, and all the men that I've come in contact with and all the people interviewed, it's like, it's the hero's journey. For the guys, it's the, we grow up and we leave our heart behind and we go do what we're supposed to do. We go climb this ladder in whatever form it takes. And we may not be happy. And so many times there's just emptiness that guys have. They don't know what it is, but they know that they're supposed to climb the ladder. You know, that's how you achieve happiness. That's how you provide and so forth. But at some point, it all falls apart. And that was my story. And my health got me, and I fell. And it wasn't until I came back and found out what was here, what was this burn, it was this achiness that felt empty, that I recognized that that was my heart speaking to me. It had been speaking to me all these years. And I can go back and look at pictures and photographs and things that I did that were all about heart, but I was pushing that down and going after the career growth. And, I guess that's okay for a time to get oneself established if needed. But it brought me down eventually. And it was only in the 2018, I guess, maybe some leading up to that, that I really decided to follow my heart. I had had a couple of health scares, and finally the last one was, this is it. You know, something's calling me to do something different. And as soon as I did, the fall of 2018, everything changed.
Mm.
Everything was aligned, and everything took off. And like, well, I don't know where this is going, but it feels right. It was the first time in my life that I ever really listened to my feelings. This was not intellectual. This was a feelings thing. And the more I did it, the better I felt, the more the energy changed around me. And here I am.
Thank you for that. It resonates with me deeply. There are a lot of medical facts I could spew out and say, oh, the frick, males have a lot of cholesterol and we all ate grease. But in fact, I was blocking my heart. And I did quite well with concepts and ideas, but my heart was blocked.
Yeah.
Till it literally was 99% blocked, and they had to put stents in it. After that, I'd already run across servant leadership, but after that, I said, look, I got to quit what I'm doing here and only do what I'm told to do.
Right.
By my heart.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got to be cleaned out. The pathways to it have to be cleaned out. It's the Native Americans, you know, with the talking stick and
yeah,
all that. The fact is that if you don't stand up and speak from the heart, I've been in some men's groups where we do this kind of exercise.
Mm-hmm.
People will kindly nod, but they don't get excited. They don't have to go pee because they're so excited. Because you're just saying stuff.
Yeah.
It means to be human, but also what it means to be a compassionate male. Now, I suspect that Zelensky has, you could probably check off all the boxes for compassionate bail for him, but doesn't mean he's not out there in his army fatigues doing what he has to do to pray to protect his people. I'm compassionate. I'm not going to fight back. No, that's not what it means.
So true.
It's a hard lesson for some people to learn. It's like servant leadership. A lot of people think it means being a martyr and not attending to your own needs. Mm. Nothing could be further from the truth. If you don't attend to your own needs, go in and go down, you're going to be a poor leader.
Yeah. Hmm.
Boy, so many things are running through my mind right now. Our experiences health wise are very close to one another, and heart being blocked, call it metaphorical or call it physical, you know, the blockage. Wow.
And what's so ironic is that I blocked my heart to handle my feelings by not facing them directly, I suspect. I say suspect because I know at some level that's true.
Mm-hmm.
And that very blockage almost gave me a widowmaker, what they call the widowmaker, and the heart docs talk about.
Yep.
It about killed me.
Yep.
So by blocking it, I just about killed myself.
Yes, I so get that. And that happened in 07. I ended up under the knife, you know, quintuple bypass. And later on, I ended up having a stent because of that very thing.
Yeah. Got four of them.
Yeah, there you go. And that's when I asked myself, you know, I was commuting to New York at the time back and forth, and my office was on Park and 32nd Street. And I'd sit in my office and I'd look up at the Empire State Building, you know, never been up there. And when I went back after I convalesced from my bypass surgery, I thought, I've never been up there. So I went up. This was the fall of December 2000. 2017. No, this was the fall of 2007. I went up there and I said, you know, metaphorically, I've made it to the top. I'm at the top of the Empire State Building. You know, it's almost killed me. And of course, you know what came next. You know, who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? You know, I looked at my little office window down there and I thought, what's this all about? And that's when the market crashed and I was let go, and wasn't for 2 years before I got my next job.
And it was for $9 an hour part-time at Office Max. You know, so I went from the top, basically the bottom, and started over again. And that's where it was, that evolution that really woke me up. You know,
I've wondered, I had probably 10 or 12 careers. I don't mean jobs, I mean careers. But in several of them, I was in the public eye, hosted a television show for the Museum of Art and did a radio series, blah, blah, blah. But I had to start wondering what part hubris was playing. And because there's a thing out there, the persona that you can build. You don't just do it in media. I found a lot of wounded people in radio and television who probably, like me, had a hard time uniting their vocation and their avocation.
Yeah.
And who they were and who they wanted to be seen as.
Mm-hmm.
It's another deadly thing, but there's a kind of hubris there. And boy, just hate to have to admit stuff like that. I just, I'm going to go, I'll drive around the block or something before I want to really get into that. It's called the shadows.
Yeah.
And I think that's where a lot of courage comes in for people.
Yeah.
Being able to turn and face them.
Yeah. When was it that you really got rolling with servant leadership? I mean, you're the official biographer for the late Robert Greenleaf. And you told in a previous podcast kind of all the evolution of that. But there was a point when all those careers, which you really took off and dedicated yourself to the advancement of servant leadership. Can you talk about that some?
Yes, I got Greenleaf's original essay, The Servant as Leader, one day in 1986. And it came in a padded envelope from my mentor who lived in Dallas, Ann McGee Cooper. So I opened it up. Eventually, I laid around a couple of days and read it and was riveted and decided after I closed the last page that I would devote the rest of my career to trying to understand and share these ideas. And that was it. Now, that was not my style necessarily to say, oh, okay, I see this, I'll just change my life. It wasn't unprecedented. One night in graduate school, I worked late at a radio station, came back, and there was one light on in the dorm. And the guy was I was in seminary, first year of seminary. And there was a guy there who I liked. He was kind of a draft dodger, I think. He was waiting till he turned 26. But he just said, you really need to go to England or Scotland next year for your second year of seminary. And I said, why? And he said, well, I went to England and blah, blah, blah. So I walked out and called my sister and said, I'm going to Scotland next year. Boom, just like that. It sounds foolish. It sounds foolish to change my career just like that. But I was saying yes. I didn't initiate the request. The request came from somewhere else. And there was a solid rightness about it. And you know what? Thank God I did. Thank God that I take no responsibility for creating that, except that I had the doors of perception open long enough for it to sneak in and make itself known. And why, that's where a lot.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Why Scotland?
I'm one quarter Scottish.
Uh-huh.
I always wanted to go there. And I wanted to learn a little bit more about my grandmother and where she came from near Glasgow. Okay. But also, Scotland in theology is a pretty big deal place. The University of Scotland had some high-end theologians through the years. And I wanted to test myself there, too. So I bought a motorcycle and ran around Europe after that and, you know, did all that kind of stuff. And I'm glad I did. But how often have I been open to awe? I've asked myself that since. That was an awful, A-W-E, awful moment when this thing crashed into my consciousness. And I wonder if there have been times since that insights of similar import haven't tried to get in there and I was too busy.
Boy, that's a real, that's really something to reflect on. How many times is it just right below the surface?
Yep.
And there's just enough resistance. No, I can't do that. Just enough resistance to keep it just an inch or two below the waterline.
Mm-hmm.
And it really gives me pause as you're saying that, because that time when I said yes, when I quit my work, you know, I'd had another heart scare. I was okay. I came home and I said to Laurie, I said, you know, I was in Jamaica in 2007 in the woods, knowing I was going to have a heart attack and just finding peace. Yeah, it's hard to describe, but I knew I was leaning against the veil. I knew I was going to die and I wasn't going to go to the hospital there. But I felt at peace with all that. How that happened, I don't know. And when I got back, sure enough, I went in. But I said to her after this latest heart scare in 2018, I said, you know, I was in the woods in Jamaica doing what was in my heart to do, doing my little crafts and so forth, and knowing I was going to die. So I was doing what was in my heart there. Now, who's to say today's not my last day, and am I doing what's in my heart right now?
That's right.
And if not now, when am I going to do it? And that's what sparked me to leave and start this path.
I think if something odd and irresistible comes to us, because it's on the fringes of not of consensual reality. I mean, it's a kind of non-consensual reality. I think that is a high alert that we should pay attention. And I'm almost glad here. Yeah, I am glad I'm 75 years old. I don't have the same passions of making it. My making it now is to try to make a difference for other people as much as I can. Knowing now that that's not all up to me, that it is, it's in communion with other people who care, or that I'm supposed to be working with in certain ways, and I'm doing that. So it is mysterious, but it's real. That's it. Something can be mysterious and still be real as dirt. It's holding those two things in our mind simultaneously that Einstein called genius. Not that we are, but it's very difficult to do, especially in this culture.
Yeah. Yeah. So binary.
Check out the latest episode of In Search of the New Compassionate Male on your favorite podcast station.